Welcome to the Atom Ventures podcast. My name is Bhairav Patel. I am the Managing Director of Atom Ventures and Atom CTO, and I have the great pleasure of talking to Teo Bamaduro from Max in Nigeria. Say hello, Teo.
Hello.
How are you?
Good, doing very well. How are you doing?
So there are honestly many, many things I want to talk to you about. You know, you have a great business that you've just started in Nigeria. You have a fascinating background. And there's so many different topics I want to touch, but let's just start off with the basics. How did you, what was your journey to start Max? I know that you were from university, you started your own business, and then you went into corporate lifestyle, and then you went back out of corporate lifestyle to start your new business. How was that journey?
Sure. I mean, happy to go into that. So, you know, how did this all start? I'd say, you know, for me and my co-founder, we're both Nigerians. But before we started the company as students at MIT in 2014, a lot of my career was previously in consulting, oil and gas, and diversified, you know, services company out of Nigeria. And did that for a couple of years. But through that experience, right, working in Nigeria, working in the Niger Delta part of Nigeria, which is well known for oil and gas, but also quite well known for environmental disasters, right, and poverty, you know, with the local community. At some point, I grew frustrated with some of the challenges that I observed every day going to work and seeing, you know, so much opportunity on one hand, but also so much poverty on the other hand, right? And I started to think about, you know, how I would best make an impact. You know, could I do that by, you know, staying on in my current job, or was there a better way, right? And then I caught the entrepreneurship or the social entrepreneurship bug, right? And then I, you know, went and studied for 2 years at MIT. At Sloan School of Management. And while there, you know, connected with a couple of amazing people, amazing friends, amazing faculty, and just, you know, overall exposure to the incredible American innovation ecosystem, right? And I have never recovered ever since. So started working on the idea for Max to sort of like, you know, transform mobility and last mile logistics on the continent. And it's been quite an amazing journey since.
So I've got to ask you that question. So you talked about Sloan, you talked about MIT. Why the US? Because every Nigerian that I know is an entrepreneur generally, right? They're all businessmen. So what did you learn from those places that you couldn't have learned in Nigeria? I mean,
Yeah, great question. So I mean, entrepreneurship is everywhere, right? If you look at some research, 60-70% of the population, especially in places like Nigeria and developing countries, most people are entrepreneurs or small business owners, right? But what was different about the experience that I had at MIT and in the US in general is, you know, the difference between high impact, innovation-driven entrepreneurship and the necessity entrepreneurship. So there's, you know, starting a company and a business, you know, because you need to make money, you need to feed your family, and there are no jobs, right? That's one type of entrepreneurship. There's another type which is born out of, you know, a desire to sort of like drive social change. So it's more like, you know, modern activism, right? You know, which isn't just about protests and all the, you know, traditional stuff that has been done historically, but also figuring out, you know, how do I, at least for me personally, how do I drive social change, you know, using entrepreneurship as a tool? And you find a lot of that, you know, in the US, right? You know, with what technology has done, opening up opportunities for people to express themselves, to connect, you know, with people across the world. We've seen, you know, the impact of innovation in social media as well. And these amazing tools have essentially, you know, given a voice to the voiceless over the last, you know, our couple of years. So for me, it was sort of like, you know, going to that country where a lot of these amazing tools have come, you know, have been developed, right? And figuring out how I could, you know, maximize that experience and then build, you know, a company, a social enterprise that would also deliver the sort of impact that I was looking to deliver in clear, measurable, sustainable ways, right, to my community and to my continent back in Africa. So I'd say that our American ecosystem would, you know, provide a much stronger ecosystem for me to learn that, you know, than staying back in my home country.
Do you feel that there weren't any role models? Like, I mean, from what you're saying, you went to the US, you learned how to kind of create high impact businesses. Wasn't there anything around that when you were growing up in Nigeria? Was it all necessity based businesses, or was there anything that you looked up to in Nigeria that you thought, I want to do that?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So honestly, a lot of the people that I looked up to in Nigeria were activists, right? Social activists, folks, you know, driving for economic development, for equity, for justice. And I mean, a little bit of historical context, and this is similar for most African countries. You know, we had dictatorships, right? And military governments for many years. You know, your citizens' rights are suppressed. You know, you can't voice, you can't be, you know, be a dissident. You can't, you know, express dissent in any way, right? So I think, you know, growing up through that experience, I had really no choice, right? A lot of the business folks, a lot of the folks that built large businesses as well, you know, built it because they were in bed with the government, right? You know, so, you know, unfortunately, there wasn't really a lot of people to look up to from a business or a governance standpoint, which left, you know, a few options with activists, you know, some of whom had also, you know, experienced quite a reasonable amount of success in the private sector, but, you know, chose to sacrifice their own personal safety to fight for, you know, for the people, for the rights of the people, right? But, you know, I mean, fast forward a few years, you know, I grew up, right? You know, and thankfully in our generation, there are a lot more tools available to us than they had then. And now, you know, social entrepreneurship is a thing where you can actually use innovation, technology innovation and business, right? To actually drive us forward social change. Now, what sort of examples did I see, you know, globally, right? So maybe not necessarily the classic Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, right? Or the classic, you know, billionaires that we've seen today. But a lot of the success and the progress that we've seen in the developed world and in the US, to be more specific, right, was enabled by you know, highly innovative but also highly selfless people, right? So, for example, look at someone like Tim Berners-Lee, right? Yeah. We invented the World Wide Web, you know, and as faculty at MIT, and a bunch of other amazing innovators who built the tools that have delivered, you know, the progress and the success that we enjoy today. You know, even when you look at the biggest companies from a market capitalization standpoint today in tech, like Apple and the rest of them, you know, every one of these companies also relied on amazingly selfless innovators, right, who either invented the technologies that they then built on and scaled, or folks who actually literally walked in those places. I mean, we all know that the core of Google's engineers at the very beginning were all PhDs, right? You know, you don't go into academia, you know, trying to make a lot of money. Nobody does that, right? You go there because you're trying to change the world. You're trying to, you know, impact knowledge on people. You're trying to do groundbreaking research, right? And you can still see that. You saw that through, especially the early years in Google with the, you know, mantra of don't be evil and stuff like that. And how the tools they built, you know, fundamentally have changed the world. So I think that was more the attraction for me, not necessarily, you know, try to, you know, build a big business and become a billionaire, not that type of incentive, but more around how innovative people and scientists, engineers have created the tools that have then formed the building blocks of the amazing technologies that have changed the world today.
So you're sitting there, you've met the guys at MIT in Sloan, you're thinking, I want to change the way that people do business and start a new business in Nigeria, right? So how do you break the mold? How do you do it differently? How do you not do everything that you said just now? How do you not be part of the government corruption? How do you do something that actually works for the people and is really for everyone, and everyone can gain advantage from it? So what was your mindset? How did you do that?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, right? So let's think about this in the form of maybe a simple framework and say, how do you actually deliver change in an emerging market or a developing country, right? So number one, you need tools and resources. So you need money, right? So you need to fundraise to get an idea off the ground. That's one. Second thing is you actually need, you know, talent, right? Which actually starts with yourself. You need to get exposed to the very best. How do they do things? How do they think? How do they, you know, solve problems? Or what kind of frameworks do they use, right? So there's the education part of it. So there's education, there's money, and then there's networks, right? That you need. You need mentors, you know, for different aspects of what they try to do, for marketing, for product development and design, for leadership, you know, and all of that. So let's pick those three, for example. So number one, education, right? You know, where do I get access to the sort of education that empowers me and enables me to be able to deliver this sort of impact, right? A lot of that, you know, is in the developed world, right? So that's, you know, it's pretty straightforward why I had to go to the US to learn this. The second part is how do you unlock resources and funding to get these ideas off the ground, right? And we all know as well, right, you know, it's in the US where you find, you know, crazy people betting on big ideas and putting in a lot of money to back those ideas. Even when those ideas do not work, you know, it's not seen as failure, right? Yes, it's failure in the sense that you've lost money, but you know, it's not, you're not demonized, you're not you know, visualized or viewed as a failure by society. In fact, it's almost a badge of honor to have tried several ideas and learned from them, right? So where do you find that? You know, even in Europe, you know, it's not something you really readily find in Europe. It's in the US, and now, of course, the culture in Europe is starting to change as well and around the world. So the education, the funding that I needed, you know, even till now, historically from 2015 to date, we've raised about $10 million in equity funding. And I'd say roughly, you know, 70 to 80% of all that funding has come from Americans, right? A lot of them Americans who have never been to Nigeria. You know, you know how crazy that sounds? And of course, last but not least is networks, right? You know, and building a company, building an innovative that challenges the status quo, right? Is something that it's still quite new in this part of the world, right? So your expectations from your staff, right? You know, you don't run a traditional hierarchical system where everything rushes to the top. You know, we're trying to build something new here. So it means we need leadership at every layer of the organization. So figuring out how to actually build a team that understands that, how to mentor them, how to provide a different kind of leadership than you know, relative to what a lot of you know, people have experienced locally in Nigeria, right? I would need a lot of mentoring to actually make that happen. So I'd say for those, at least those three reasons are probably more, right? You know, it made perfect sense to get, you know, exposed to the US innovation ecosystem.
So I listened recently. I read a statistic that if you look at the African startups, it was something like out of the top 10 funded startups, 8 of them were fronted by white people, right? And they weren't funded by people like yourself, who you're a black founder, right? You're a Nigerian, you're an African founder. Did you find it hard to break into it? And like, did you find it hard to get people to take you seriously? I guess that's the first question.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question, right? So I'll answer this in two ways. So from my personal experience, and then from what I think is my experience. So from my personal experience, I mean, fundraising is tough for everybody, you know, white, black, pink, yellow, brown, right? No. Fundraising is hard, right? It's not a guarantee for anybody, irrespective of who you are, right?
Yep.
But, you know, it took a lot of work, you know, and but we also got a lot of, you know, we got people willing to listen to us. A lot of the people we reached out to, irrespective of their racial backgrounds, were willing to listen to us at the least, right? Which is very respectful, and we deeply appreciated that. So for people who are not, you know, are lucky enough to have, you know, the background that I had, you know, attending a school like MIT and connecting with like super smart people, and also going through the TechStars Startup Accelerator program in New York, you know, that gave us a lot of credibility and made it a little bit easier for us to, you know, to get attention. But I'd say for the average black founder out there who may not have had access to some of the opportunities that we've had, it's probably a completely different experience.
So, okay. So then I've got a whole bunch of questions around that as well, in how do you nurture the next generation? But before I get onto that question, what I would like to ask you is, when you came back to Nigeria and, you know, you have to convince people to change their daily ways of thinking. So when I was looking at your website, one of the great things that I saw that you were saying was that, you know, most drivers are independent, right? So most people are independently owning their own wage and making their own thing. So you now have to convince them that working for you is better than them just trying to hustle on the streets. How do you do that? How did you convince the people around you that this is the business and you know, bring them in and say, look, we can do this in a much more organized way?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it was a particularly tough challenge for us, right? So, I mean, unfortunately, in a part of the world like this, and I guess maybe even, you know, globally, right? When you're trying to get people to change their behavior, right? You have to present incentives that make sense to them, and you know, unfortunately or unfortunately, in our case, you know, the promise that they would make more money or at least as much money with a few added benefits was extremely important and central to being able to convince them to come on board our platform, right? So we essentially had to present a better alternative economic opportunity to them, which of course, you know, is tough, right? Because that means you have to spend money, you have to invest resources, and you have to come up with super creative ideas, you know, even beyond just providing them better economic opportunities. Because also, you know, there's the legacy of folks not always trusting new ideas because they're not sure what's the catch. Is there a catch here? Is there a risk that I might lose something if I join this platform? So we had to figure out how to communicate our value proposition in a way that resonated with our local audience. And that took several months, if not, you know, almost years, right, of iteration and figuring out, you know, what resonated and what didn't before we finally figured out a compelling value proposition that we're now trying to scale.
How quickly did you grow? How many people did you start off with, and how many people are you at now? And just to give a little bit of background, because I think we've just went straight into the conversation and we haven't really talked about what you actually do, and no one, I think, understands that. So.
Sure. So we started with actually three drivers, right? And now we've scaled to about 2,500, you know, drivers financed on the platform. So it's not a million drivers yet, but we're slowly getting there. But we started from three, and now we're at, 2,500, thereabouts.
That's huge. And Nigeria is a huge country as well. So this is all very big. But So going back to the theme of you trying to create a different type of business, not one that is part of the government, not one that is self-serving. What were the additional things that you offered in order to, you know, engage people? Like, what was it? If I'm looking at a business like this, let's say in India, where people are doing the same thing, what did you do that just brings people to to believe in you? How did you make people believe in what you're doing?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So, I mean, the first thing is, you know, you have to be authentic, right? And how do you prove that? By showing that you're actually one of them. So I and my co-founder and exec team, we actually learned how to ride motorcycles and do the business ourselves. So we would ride around and go connect with these guys on the streets, right? And for them, that was quite different because, you know, what would, the expectation would be, you know, for you to drive around in you know, nice, comfortable cars and all of that. But actually identifying with them at that level and actually understanding what it takes to ride motor taxis around the city, right, gave us instant credibility with our target customers. That's number one. The second thing also is figuring out, you know, how to solve some of the other problems, right, and provide some of the other benefits that they don't have access to as independent transport operators. And that includes things like, you know, health insurance, coverage for not just themselves, but also their families, accident insurance. If they get into an accident, they can get comprehensive medical help, you know, medical support, providing them access to digital wallets, guaranteeing security of their vehicles and assets, you know, using the IoT platform that we had built and the remote tracking platform we had built, and that essentially made it nearly impossible for the vehicles to get stolen by, you know, by thieves and thugs and stuff like that. And a bunch of other things that we, you know, pulled together into a suite of value-added services, right? For the drivers, you know, they find all of those irresistible. And then we took it a step further as well by, you know, figuring out how to actually get them access to high-quality vehicles, right? So for a lot of these guys on their own, they typically would kind of afford high-quality vehicles that, you know, are safer and would last a lot longer, right? But we created a scheme and a program and brought the manufacturer in to the partnership to create a way for these drivers, right, to be able to, in a very affordable and comfortable way, afford to get access to high-quality premium vehicles, right? So if you think about it, you know, how, you know, vehicle acquisition works in the U.S. or in developed countries, you know, nobody, you know, shells out $10,000 to buy a vehicle, right? You know, you just pay monthly, $200 a month or whatever it is, right? And then you can trade that car, you know, when a new one comes out, right? In this part of the world, you know, nobody does that. Nobody has access to that, right? You know, if you have to buy a $20,000 car, you shell out that amount upfront one time. So providing that financial inclusion support to our drivers also was quite phenomenal for them. So, I mean, so far, you know, it took a while, of course, to figure out all of those things, but now we have a compelling value proposition that is simply just irresistible to our drivers.
But it sounds to me, right, that you had to change a lot to get to your state now, right? So you talked about health insurance, you're talking about high quality vehicles. I mean, no one is doing what you've been doing. So you must have had to convince the insurance people that suddenly you're now going to get you know, 2,500 drivers, 25,000 drivers who are going to be health insured. That's something that was never there before, right? And then now you've got to get the high quality. So you must have had to kind of carve through a whole bunch of different, you know, you had to carve through a whole new path before you can get to where you are now. I mean, how difficult was that? I mean, how much do you have to fight the establishment and all the current thinking to get to where you are now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been 5 years of, it's been five nonstop years of you know, of acting like Navy SEALs, right? You know, as you said, you know, going up against entrenched ideas, going up against failures in governance, going up against distrust, you know, amongst the people and all of that. So yes, you know, it's taken a huge amount of work to convince partners to sign up with us, to convince initially drivers to join our platform. But I mean, we've stayed the course, right? You know, we've been resilient. We've kept believing, and we've been very fortunate as well to enlist, you know, some really high quality partners and investors locally and globally as well. So on the one hand, it's been super challenging, but on the other hand, we've also gotten a tremendous amount of help and support, which is why we're still.
So how did you get your customers? So obviously we started with three drivers. How did you build your customer? Which did you build first? Did you build the driver base first, or did you build the customer base first?
Fantastic. That's a classic question for building multi-sided marketplaces, right? So in our case, you build supply first. You build drivers first, and you use some tactics and some artificial ramps or means to hold them initially while you build up the demand side of the market, right? So we started out by building the supply side first, bringing drivers on board, training them, providing them the resources they needed. And then once we got that moving forward, then we started building the demand side. And then ever since, you know, we've been building both sides concurrently.
So if you're doing it again, would you do it the same way?
We will start by building the supply side first. If you had to do it again, but of course we would go about it differently, because now we've learned a lot of lessons. Now we know, you know, what to do and what not to do, you know. But as they say, hindsight is 20/20, right? So I think our focus has been on, you know, learning very quickly, making our mistakes very quickly, learning from them, and making the platform, you know, much better. So yes, if we had to do it all over again, you know, we will do things much better, but we will start out by building the supply side first.
All right. So let me touch back on one of the points you mentioned. So you talked about education, networking, mentoring, right? Education, finance, and mentoring. But so how are you mentoring the next generation, or are you? What do you feel the next generation could be? Because, you know, we talked about you when you were looking at the people who were owning businesses before you, that wasn't the right way of building something that helps everyone around them. Now you have done that and you are doing it. What is your next step? Do you feel like you're the godfather, the forefather of the next generation? And if that's so, how are you going to help them?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, godfather, absolutely not, right? You know, as permit me to reference a quote from one of Jeff Bezos, interviews, where he said that, you know, with respect to building Blue Origin. And then, you know, was asked the question, you know, are you building Blue Origin because NASA failed, you know, to make spaceflight, you know, accessible to the common man, right? You know, and then he responded and said, absolutely not, right? Blue Origin is doing what it is today because of what NASA did, right? So it's the same thing for us as well. Where we are, and because of the incredible amount of support we've received, you know, globally, of course, and also locally, we've got one or two funds locally and a bunch of mentors who've provided an incredible amount of support and encouragement to us, right? And that's why we're doing what we're doing right now. So I think it's a journey, right? The next generation will take it further. It will be a lot more commonplace, you know, for them to build companies from the ground up out of their bedrooms, right? And the tools also are being built. So I think what my generation is doing right now is creating the next layer of infrastructure that would make it even far easier for the next generation of innovators to quickly build and quickly scale. They would scale much faster than we've seen in our generation, and they will deliver much more game-changing our products, you know, to our people.
So if you're going to give advice to the next generation, right, what would it be? What would you say to them? Like, of course, not everyone can go to MIT and Sloan. They can't like filled your boots. They can't have done Techstars. So if there's someone sitting out there listening, thinking, well, I really want to do this, but I don't have your background, what would you say?
Great. So, I mean, that's the exciting thing that's happening right now as well, where it's a lot less about your background, right? You know, maybe 10 years ago, you might have a little bit more. Maybe 6 years ago, you might have a little bit, you know, what school you went to, right? But this is 2020, right? You know, right now, it's a lot less important, right? What school you've gone to, as long as, you know, you've got a compelling vision, you've got, you know, a strong skill set and the discipline to actually go the course, right? So it's a lot less about, you know, the schools you've been to, right? And a lot more about, you know, the scale of your vision and your discipline, your ability to actually, you know, go the course, right? So what would I say to them? You know, whatever we've done is the least that, you know, you guys can do, right? So where we're ending is where you guys should start from. You know, Take the risk earlier, right? Go dive in earlier. Completely, you know, you don't need to do a lot of the stuff that we did. You don't necessarily need to spend 10 years, you know, working in large companies or doing management consulting, you know, before, you know, trying to innovate, right? So I would say they should take the risk a lot earlier, right? And, you know, they should not think anything or anyone can stop them. Just go for it.
So now you're a business owner, right? You are a business owner in Nigeria. What do you want to see happen, change around you now, right? Not only of the innovation and the new people coming in, but generally as you, as a guy who's scaling a business and it's grown massively in the last 3-5 years, what do you want to see changing around you?
Great question. And it's really one thing, right? It's unfortunately, right, young people still face a huge amount of, you know, challenges and barriers that prevent them from achieving, you know, the highest levels of their potential, right? So what do I want to see change? I want to see more deliberate investment from older entrepreneurs, from, you know, governments, from public office holders, from large corporates, right? And everyone, you know, who's gone ahead, right? I want to see a lot more deliberate effort in supporting, encouraging, and accelerating the growth of young entrepreneurs, right? Providing them the resources they need, right? You know, let me give an example, right? You know, maybe you're running hackathons, right? And then some team of innovators, they win. And then you provide them prize money of, you know, $2,000, right? That is absolutely nothing. Why not provide them $50,000? Why not provide them $100,000 to build what they're trying to build? So I still think a lot of what I'm seeing right now is a lot of lip service that's been paid, right? You know, I mean, we know what we see in the States, young entrepreneurs, 25-year-old, 23-year-old entrepreneurs with amazing ideas and amazing products, you know, can raise $10, $20, $30, $40, $50 million to build and scale their companies, right? They can hire people to work for them. You know, Mark Zuckerberg hired, what's her name now? The chief operating officer at Facebook, right? Her name just escaped my mind right now. You know, Michael helped build a much stronger operation to make that happen. So young people should be able to hire other people who may have some more experience. Of course, experience is always helpful and valuable, right? But there's absolutely nothing wrong, you know, with young 20-something entrepreneurs hiring and bringing on board older, you know, people to help, you know, help build a company, right? You don't have to step aside. You don't have to leave the company for someone else to come and run. So what I want to see is that belief in younger people and that willingness to support them rather than trying to, you know, keep them behind or restrain them or tell them they're not old enough to do stuff.
All right. So I'm going to be very controversial now on that theme, right? So, yeah. You know, you raise your money outside of Africa, outside of Nigeria. Nigeria is not a poor country, right? There are not, you know, there's plenty of wealthy people in Nigeria. Why do foreign investors have to put money into Nigeria? Why can't you get Nigerians or Ugandans or, you know, guys from Angola putting money into African startups? Why is it that you go outside for money?
That's a great question. And you know what, you know, my short answer is history is repeating itself, right? So if you think about it, you know, let's look at Nigeria and let's look at Angola, you know, all oil and gas, you know, rich countries, right? Yeah. Today, the biggest IOCs in these countries are all, you know, Western companies, you know, from the Shells to the ExxonMobils to the Totals, right? And the Chevrons, right? And so on and so forth. It's less than 10 years ago that, maybe about 10 years ago that African upstream oil and gas companies started to to play a role in this industry, right? So the question is, what happened then? You know, they just probably didn't see the opportunity. They weren't willing to take the risk. Guess what? The same thing is happening all over again. The opportunity is there. It's huge. Right now, it doesn't look to the undiscerning. It looks like it's a lot of work. You know, how does this tech thing actually work? You know, how do you build a big company? There's a lot of change that has to happen. It's difficult to scale and things like that. And if you look at that, you think maybe there's no opportunity in here, right? Especially if you're a traditional person, right, who doesn't understand what it is to actually take risks. So, but if you're an American...
You're the picture book of this, right? So you are the example of this, right? So you are the example of, so you take a risk on you, you go from 0 to 5 years, you're scaling massively, right? And you're going to complete, you're going to keep scaling. So what is it? I mean, sorry to interrupt, but yeah. You know, when I was living in Portugal, so I lived in Portugal, and the person who was owning my apartment was Angolan, and she owned a huge number of apartments in Lisbon. And you're sitting there thinking, well, okay, you're owning all this property in Lisbon, but why are you not investing that money back in Angola and in businesses and taking the risk there? Why? And so this is what I'm trying to, you know, get my head around, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that's what we've seen historically. And, you know, like I said, you know, sometimes it's a little unfortunate if, you know, the folks don't believe in their own people or in their own country, right? But also remember this, you know, the way how you spend your money ultimately, you know, provides an insight into how you made your money, right? So if you made your money by investing and betting on companies and taking risks in the US, right, you know you can replicate that, not just in the US, but anywhere else in the world. So wherever you find opportunity, you know there's risk in there. You know you could lose it. That's why you have, you know, that's why you follow standard portfolio distribution and management practices. You put some money in some fantastic ideas in Africa, you put some in Asia, you put some in Europe, and you put, you know, some in the US as well, and you see how things, you watch how things grow, right? So they're used to taking risks. The reverse is the case with a lot of the wealthy elite in Africa, where they made their money, you know, not by necessarily investing in businesses, but true state capture, true, you know, having access to natural resources, true things that didn't necessarily require a lot of like risk-taking and strategy and acumen, right? But more true are influencing the state, right? So if you have a lot of, you know, and now, you know, this doesn't speak to your example, but if a lot of the wealth you have was either transferred to you as inheritance, right? Or you got it through state capture, not necessarily through innovating, or better still, through innovating, investing in technology, right? It's very hard to learn that once you're in your 50s and 60s and 70s, right? So what we need right here, and this is what is going to happen, right? The current generation of entrepreneurs, you know, in my generation, hopefully at some point we'll get some, you know, decent and amazing exits. Then they would become the local investors who back technology entrepreneurs, right? That's what's going to happen. So hopefully over the next couple of years, you know, we would see that change start to happen. But if the expectation is that at some point we would see a lot of the older folks who made their money, you know, through state capture and stuff like that, if you think that they're going to change and at some point see the value in technology, maybe they would, but by the time they do that, it probably would be too late. All the best deals would have been gone by then.
Everything you say resounds with me. And I think actually, if you look at it, if you turn everything on its head, if you turn everyone who's got money and you just turn everything upside down, I think the people at the bottom of the pyramid actually take risks every day, right? All your riders, they take a risk every day doing whatever they do. I think the people at the top are not taking any risks at all. And they're getting fat off the fact that they're not taking any risks. Whereas every day,
amazing.
They're hustling, their people are hustling.
Exactly. Every
day, right.
And absolutely.
I always think entrepreneur, the word entrepreneur, I think is corrupted over the years, because I look at my father, he owned a sweet shop, right? He was an entrepreneur. Like anyone who starts a business, anyone who makes money for selling services or products is an entrepreneur, right? They're not.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but anyway, a different discussion, my friend. So I'll ask you, the last question I'll ask you is this, and I ask this to everyone I ever have a podcast with. If you could go back in time 20 years and give advice to your younger self, what would that advice be?
Okay, great. Yeah, if I could go 20 years in the past, what would I do, right? Could I take current ideas with me back into the
you
past?
Imagine you go back in time and you tap yourself on the shoulder and say, hey, I'm Theo. I'm 20 years in your future. don't do this, do that. And, you know, most people will say buy Bitcoin, but it's like, don't say that.
So, yeah, I mean, what would I do, right? I would put all of my energy much earlier into technology innovation, technology-based innovation, right? And, you know, sort of like ignore almost everything else. That's number one. Number two would be that I would put a lot less trust and hope, have a lot less trust and hope in, you know, in the government or in, you know, leaders changing things, right? Because I'd say 20 years ago, I still kind of like had that hope that, yeah, you know, you could put a lot of pressure on these guys to do better, to invest a little bit more in infrastructure, in education, provide opportunities for young people and stuff like that, right? So 20 years, I would absolutely have, you know, just taken a lot of things into my own hands and put not just my future, but the future of my country into my own hands and not leave it to anyone else.
And I think that's a great message for every single person that you're talking to, all the founders that come behind you, right? Take it in your hands, take control of your own destiny.
Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thanks for that. It's been great. It's been great talking to you. It's been a fantastic conversation, and I wish you best of luck with Max.
Thanks. Great talking to you as well. And hopefully this is helpful for a couple of folks listening out there.
Excellent. Cheers.